I'm sure you guys have seen it somewhere. You guys have listened to it, heard it, watched it, or saw it, or even read it. There has been even more fierce, more perfervid debate over abortion, over the right to an abortion, or the right to life. This is, of course, the most execrated stance one could have, is an opinion on abortion. That abortion is either a bad thing or a good thing. That a woman's choice is more important than the right of the child to live, or the right of the child to live is less important or is more important than the right of the woman to have rights. So it's really truly a moral versus a moral argument. We have two warring sides that are truly, completely, and diametrically opposed to one another. And in the end, with a topic like this, with an issue like this, there is no respite. There is no compromise. It is either one side wins or one side loses. You can't just give abortion to 25 states and expect that it's a win and a win and a loss and a loss. It won't be. It will be one loss and one win. If 25 states have abortion, 25 states don't, it'll be a win for pro-lifers, kind of. And it'll be a pretty large loss for pro-choicers. And in retrospect, what we have right now, 50 states legalizing, having legal abortion, at least until 6 weeks because of SB 8, you still see that the pro-lifers regard that as a loss. And to them, it is a loss because their whole point is in illegalizing, outlawing, banning abortions. So this debate is truly extremely perfervid. And there are difficulties in both regular society and law that deal particularly with this topic. Now, we're going to go into this topic and we're going to discuss it in depth. We're going to discuss abortion, basically the history of abortion and the debate over abortion, and infuse it with the right to privacy, selective incorporation, a variety of cases. You'll probably recognize several of them because most of them are pretty popular, contemporaneously popular even. Many of them are in the news, let's just say it that way. We will also talk about particularly the history of the right to privacy, what its constitutional backdrop is. You could say backdrop, but really it's like what its constitutional justification is. We're going to look at what a stare decisis is and determine why I don't think that the present court is going to follow the stare decisis from Roe v. Wade in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. For some reason, I just completely forgot about that. But yeah, so we're going to discuss basically everything pretty well in depth. We're going to get into constitutional law. I love constitutional law, so we might as well do it. This is, just so you know, following the typical season 2 setup. We're going to be doing one speech-based episode every 3 weeks, or potentially even every 4 weeks, depending on how long it takes me to finish essays. And then we'll do a variety of different things that are more, I just talk to the microphone, with a semi-prepared presentation, but not a speech. So basically whatever I think is interesting, and this is going to be interesting because I had a discussion with my government teacher on this, with my AP Gov teacher, and I thought that it was just going to be, it was an interesting topic to investigate a little bit more. And when I'm talking, normally I figure out things that I didn't know, even about the things I'm reading about. And I think this is a good method to help teach myself more. And of course, teach you guys more if you don't know anything about constitutional law, which after this you will, let's just say it that way. But anyway, there is this certain thing called the right to privacy. I'm sure you've probably heard of it. You may have heard of it in its various forms. such as the right to be left alone. And this actually transitions into the origins of the right to privacy. Now, of course, the right to privacy is not even in the Constitution. It's like equality. Not in the Constitution, except for once. Equal protection of the laws, 14th Amendment. That's the only place where you're ever going to find equal in the entire Constitution. Well, privacy, there isn't any. It does not exist in the Constitution. There's not a single word that says privacy. So this is one of the situations in which it's not enumerated. What you're looking at is not enumerated. Instead, it's merely implied. And we see through the right to privacy that it was established by court precedent. So it's an informal change to the Constitution, basically. The right to privacy itself began with Louis Brandeis's right to privacy. It was an article published in the Harvard Law Review. I believe it was in 1890. Louis Brandeis actually was a Supreme Court justice, and he also has a university named after him. It's a pretty prestigious Jewish college. I think it's in New York. Don't quote me on it. It's Brandeis College. I just actually saw that when I was looking him up, because I'm actually preparing a speech on abortion, on particularly the opinions of abortion, something that's a little bit more objective, not as objective as this, but pretty objective, especially for an abortion debate. But essentially, Louis Brandeis, he argued for the right to privacy. I mean, of course, this is an article, and the thing about it was that it was really the first U.S. publication to advocate for the right to privacy. Like, it was the first one. I'm not sure about other countries, but at least in the United States, it was the first one. And this was, of course, in 1890, which was, what, 131 years ago? So, still pretty long ago, and actually that's over halfway since, that doesn't matter, but it's been 245 years since we signed the Declaration of Independence. So, yeah, a little bit over halfway to the beginning of our country that this has existed. So it's not necessarily new, but you'll see how it's pretty novel. So it actually never was really established. This was an advocation, particularly existing in a law study, like a law review, in an article, like an opinion law-based article, but it never had any judicial or there's no litigation related to it, essentially, is what I mean. There never anything happened, even for, like, what, 71 years after it happened? Even then, technically, not even then. So we transition now to a case called Poe v. Ullman, in 1961, in which the Supreme Court dismissed a case against Connecticut's anti-birth control law. You may know of this because of another case, because there was no, they called it immediate injury to the plaintiffs. Basically, they had not and would not be affected by the law, for the law had never been enforced. So this is one of those situations in which the court, working in hindsight, they may have been smart enough to realize that it would be enforced. And that brings us to the next case. So 4 years later, the same law went to the court. The same Connecticut law went to the court. This was in the famous case, I'm sure you probably know it, Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965, where there was actually some injury to the plaintiff. So you have there was a private citizen and another private citizen, who was the head of Planned Parenthood in Connecticut. They started basically a birth control clinic, and they actually got charged for it. They actually were prosecuted, and their whole point was to challenge it in court, and of course they challenged it in court. And in a 7-2 ruling, the court nullified the law. So this was interesting. It was definitely an interesting ruling. The really interesting part about this ruling was that this was the first establishment of the right to privacy. So even 75 years after Louis Brandeis's article, still, it took 75 years. Yeah, it was 1890. It took 75 years to actually establish that right to privacy. So this was an informal change to the Constitution based upon judicial interpretation. Now, they used as justification four amendments. So you could say it's through the scope or through the lens of one. It's arguable, but basically, yeah. So the four amendments are the First Amendment. I'm pretty sure everyone knows what the First Amendment is. Speech, religious liberty, press, petition and assembly, etc. That's an obvious one. Also the Third Amendment. So my cousin made this joke to me recently. We really need civil rights attorneys who are experts in Third Amendment rights. So if anyone knows what the Third Amendment is, I'm sure most of you know what the Third Amendment is. It essentially it prohibits like forced quartering of soldiers. So you can't just a soldier can't just walk into your house and be like, oh yeah, I have to live here. And granted, that's only in times of peace, but like still, that's what the Third Amendment is. They also said the Fourth Amendment. They also cited the Fourth Amendment as justification. And this one also made a lot of sense. Of course, the Third Amendment makes sense too, because this is technically to be private in your person anyway, because a soldier can't just enter your house, specifically during peacetime. And actually, you can't even in the time of war. Of course, this doesn't apply to, families, but you know what I mean. So a soldier can't just, walk into your house and be like, yeah, I live here now. That was a huge problem during the ratification. It's obviously not a problem now, but it was used as justification because it makes sense. This is where privacy would be. You have the right to have privacy against government officials in your own home. And you could argue that a soldier is a government official. They're technically non-citizens. Well, they are citizens, but they're not like the merchant, for example. They're soldiers. They're stated by the government to exist in a particular spot to do a particular job. They're government workers, essentially. So that was the Third Amendment. And the Fourth Amendment, this is protection against unreasonable search and seizure. That one's by far the most obvious example of the right to privacy. So actually, even the closest to privacy that you probably get in the entire Constitution, at least in my opinion, is, and I quote, this is a direct quote, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. So this is the very first clause of the Fourth Amendment. And, well, this is the very first portion of the Fourth Amendment. And this is privacy. Essentially, this is privacy. In effect, this is privacy. And the other amendment they cited in Griswold versus Connecticut, in the majority opinion, was the Ninth Amendment. And the Ninth Amendment, some of you may know, it's an interesting amendment. So in quotes, let's just be specific, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So basically, the rights that already exist in the Constitution, the enumerated ones, they're not the only rights that someone has. That's one thing you can say. So basically, the rights that are, for example, not reserved to the states or reserved to the government in general, those are reserved for the people. This is the personal rights kind of amendment. This is a very important amendment for obvious reasons. This was what was used as a lens in Griswold versus Connecticut, they essentially, one thing you could say is they said, they justified it with the first, third, fourth, and fourth amendments through the lens of the Ninth Amendment, which was, you could just say personal. I'm just going to call it the Personal Rights Amendment, the Personal Liberties Amendment, to be very specific, the Personal Liberties Amendment from a political science point of view. Now, later on, this right to privacy would be used often. Later on in the very famous case, and truly infamous case too, it's famous and infamous, it's truly consecrated and vilified. That's the only way I can say it. It's consecrated and vilified. It's loved and loathed. People do not love it and people adore it. Essentially, the plaintiff, Jane Roe, wanted an abortion. Jane Roe is, of course, an alias to protect the woman who sued the Dallas County District Attorney, whose name was Henry Wade, I believe. I know his last name is Wade, but I'm pretty sure his name was Henry Wade. And basically, she argued that the state laws against abortion were, and I quote, unconstitutionally vague, end quote, and violated her right to privacy protected by the 1st, 4th, 5th, 9th, and 14th Amendments. So one thing you'll see about this was that the amendments argued are different from than Griswold. Remember, they used the 1st, 3rd, 4th, and 9th as justification in Griswold. But Jane Roe, the plaintiff, and her lawyers, of course, cited the 1st, 4th, 5th, 9th, and 14th Amendments. So we've already looked at the 1st, 4th, and 9th, but let's look at the 5th. The Fifth Amendment is, of course, a pretty important one. This is the amendment that protects against self-incrimination. So, you know, you plead the Fifth, you're pleading the Fifth Amendment, so you don't have to say anything. You have your Miranda rights derived from the Fifth Amendment. And, of course, that's another informal change to the Constitution. This is a pretty important amendment, I'm sure. This also protects against double jeopardy. But the big thing is self-incrimination. This is in effect a right to privacy. You could argue that that's a liberty to privacy. You have the right to privacy protected by your Fifth Amendment protections against self-incrimination. You can be, it makes sense because you can be private in what you say or don't say. You don't have to say anything. If you are arrested, you don't have to say a word. You do not have to say a single thing. You can just be like, yep, I'm not talking until I have my lawyer, and then never have to deal with it. I mean, there's more to it than that, but like, essentially, you don't have to self-incriminate yourself. You don't have to plead. You don't have to say that you're guilty for something, even if you are guilty. You don't have to say it. You have to get the government and the lawyers and the prosecutors and, of course, a 12-person jury, generally, to accord with the belief that you committed the crime. Even if you didn't, I mean, of course, chances are you're less likely to be put in jail if you didn't commit the crime. But, again, this is a right to privacy. In effect, it is truly a right to privacy. I mean, you don't have to say anything. You can keep your matters private. And that makes sense. So let's also look at the 14th Amendment. Now, we will see that in the decision on Roe v. Wade that Amendment 14 was used as justification, particularly the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. So if we look at this, there's privileges and immunities. Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So this is substantive due process, for anyone who knows that. There's procedural and substantive. Generally, the difference between procedure, one of the differences, this is kind of a subjective difference, is that procedural due process is the Fifth Amendment, substantive due process is the 14th Amendment. And basically, you can infer that There is a certain right to privacy in this. I would not necessarily say it's as easy to see. I wouldn't necessarily argue it, but in the lens of a restrictive law, you could say that this is due process. You could say that this there is justification for this in due process. So let's look at the actual decision itself. So in a 7-2 ruling, the court sided with the plaintiff, Jane Roe, ruling that the due process clause, as I said, of the 14th Amendment protects a pregnant woman's choice whether or not to have an abortion. Of course, that's essentially the right to privacy here. And while they did allow abortion nationally, it was the supreme law of the land, as you could say. Yes, they did, but they also weighed it against the state's interest, the government's interest in protecting women's health and the, and I quote, potentiality of human life. Basically, they ruled that no restrictions or limitations on abortions could be placed on a woman's right in the first trimester. However, you could regulate it in the second trimester and ban it in the third. Now, this case, and obviously it was not a very respected case. It was very contentious, very controversial. There are a few cases that were like that. A lot of Supreme Court cases are not controversial, especially in their time. I mean, even like Plessy was controversial, but I wouldn't say it really had the controversial match of Roe v. Wade. Of course, by 1950 it did, but at the time it was decided, it was an 8-1 decision. Only John Marshall Harlan, we'll actually see his grandson, I believe it is, he was the only dissenter in the entire decision. He was the only dissenter. It was an 8-1 decision. So, of course, that's, in the time, it was one of the more contentious ones. The only other really good example I can think of where it was just regarded as a terrible, terrible opinion, but not universally, very controversially, I would say the only other decision would be Dred Scott. Dred Scott versus Sanford. That's the only one. There are others, of course, but these are the ones I can think of off the top of my head. Obergefell versus Hodges was pretty controversial too, but I mean, that's a fundamental liberty. It's relatively accepted by the general public now anyway, that I wouldn't say it was as controversial as Roe v. Wade and Dred Scott. Everyone knows Dred Scott and Roe v. Wade. Yet they were much longer ago than Obergefell. Obergefell was in 2015. Whereas I believe Dred Scott was 1857 and Roe v. Wade was 1972, I believe. Do not quote me on it. I can check right now. I believe it was 1972. It was argued in 1971 and it was decided in 1973. It was argued for the first time in 1971. So, 1971, 72, and 73. But that was the ruling in Roe v. Wade. And in a later ruling in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the court upheld, in a 5-4 ruling, Roe v. Wade, and upheld restrictive Pennsylvania anti-abortion laws. So this was kind of a contentious ruling. It was 5-4 with, I think this was where you had a 5-4 court of conservative justices. Actually, it might have been a 6-3, because I believe that David Souter was appointed by a Republican. Yes, he was a Republican himself. So this might have been a 6-3 court. So really, this was a weird one. This was definitely it was a 6-3. So this was a 6-3 conservative court. The three most conservative justices ruled against the decision in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, but Anthony Kennedy and Sandra Day O'Connor, both appointed by Republicans. Anthony Kennedy, he actually wrote the majority opinion in Obergefell. He's one of those swaying kind of independent conservative justices. Sandra Day O'Connor voted for it. That's not necessarily extremely surprising. David Souter voted for it. And he was also a Republican justice. He was appointed by a Republican. And then Blackmun and John Paul Stevens also voted for it. It was a 5-4 decision. And they essentially relied on a new precedent It was known as the undue burden doctrine, which allowed regulation in the second trimester. It allowed regulation in general, so long as it didn't place undue burden on the woman against her abortion. This was, of course, just as contentious, but pretty contentious, even in the time. It was definitely a very contentious debate. And the general argument revolves around this case and Roe v. Wade. Roe v. Wade is obviously the front runner, but Planned Parenthood versus Casey and Roe v. Wade, those are the ones that will typically arise, especially in court proceedings, in arguments, and truly in general, because when people think of abortion, they think of these two cases. They think of Planned Parenthood versus Casey and Roe v. Wade, but they're going to be thinking of more, and we'll get into that. So the issue occasions perhaps the most, this issue with abortion, whether to legalize it or not, whether to leave it up to the states or leave it up to the national government, is perhaps the most, it creates this most fervid and furious discord out of essentially any contemporary issue. We've seen this everywhere. I mean, it's been happening for decades. But there really is no other, there's no other debate that inspires such terror, such arguments, such war. It's truly incredible. I've never seen something like it. It's so hard to believe. There were two cases that arose recently. I'm sure many of you know about it. There's Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, and United States versus Texas of 2021. So let's start with the Dobbs v. Jackson. So this was a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade, and it was argued, I think it was December 1st, but don't quote me on it. December 1st. I listened to the debates, I listened to the arguments in, it was not debate, but I was listening to the arguments in my fourth hour class at my high school. And a lot of the argument, this is my own discoveries, a lot of the argument revolved around something called a stare decisis. And a stare decisis is essentially basically following the past proceedings of the court. It's a doctrine, like a doctrine of stare decisis. That's actually on the definition. And essentially, I had to look it up because I wanted to see what it was in Latin. It's literally to stand by things decided, essentially. And basically, that means to follow the precedent. And there is a lot of debate over whether to follow the stare decisis or to overrule it, or to not follow it, essentially. And the court's more conservative, you could say more conservative justices, have signaled that they want to overturn Roe, because this case is a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade. Direct challenge. They have indicated that they want to overturn it and potentially not follow the stare decisis. The best example I can think of, the loudest person for this was Brett Kavanaugh. One thing he did was list court cases in which the Supreme Court did not follow the stare decisis, and one of them he gave was Brown v. Board. There were several others that he used. Of course, he was basically just listing, most Supreme Court cases were most extremely important Supreme Court cases overruled prior precedents, the stare decisis. A good example is Lawrence v. Texas, which overruled Bowers v. Hardwick. Bowers v. Hardwick and Lawrence v. Texas dealt with anti-sodomy laws, which were essentially anti-LGBTQ laws, anti-homosexual laws, that basically banned homosexual relations. And Lawrence v. Texas basically overruled and nullified a Texas law, an anti-sodomy law in general, and made laws against anti-sodomy unconstitutional, and basically made the allowance of that, or the permission of that, of the legal permission, you could say, of sodomy the supreme law of the land. So Kavanaugh was one of them. Samuel Alito, Justice Alito, he was also pretty loud about it. He was also keen on not following the stare decisis. He wanted to basically overrule and abandon Roe v. Wade to repeal it, to overturn it, is a better word. Clarence Thomas is more conservative justice. He's on the Antonin Scalia level of conservative. This is like really like whether you call it a conservative justice or not, that's justices follow a constitutional, they follow a constitutional approach. They're not necessarily conservative or liberal. They vote conservatively or liberally, depending on what we consider conservative or liberal, but often they will vote often they'll vote based upon their own interpretation of the Constitution. A good example of this would actually be Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado. This was one where there's a 7-2 decision voting in favor. If I have this correct, yeah, two of the liberal justices, Stephen Breyer and Elena Kagan, both of them voted for Masterpiece Cake Shop. This was, I'm sure some of you know Masterpiece Cake Shop. It deals with LGBTQ rights, public accommodation laws, and a cake shop owner who cited his religious liberties in refusing a homosexual couple, a gay couple, a cake, a wedding cake for their wedding. So that's one example. Trust me, there are more. Actually, Bostock v. Clayton County is another example, because I believe Gorsuch was the one who was the majority opinion here. Yes, Neil Gorsuch and John Roberts voted alongside this extended Civil Rights Act protections, employment discrimination protections to transgender and LGBTQ people. And I believe it was, yep, Gorsuch was the one who authored the opinion for the majority. And he's actually also been cited to be one of the, he's actually been helping Native Americans with property rights, I think it's property rights, recently. So this is one of those things. It's truly, you can't really call it liberal or conservative justice because everything's different. And speaking of Gorsuch, he was one of them that may potentially vote to overturn Roe alongside Amy Coney Barrett. They both voted in the 5-4 decision to allow SB8, the Texas anti-abortion law, to remain in effect while the issue is litigated in the courts. You can basically see US v. Texas for that. That's the 2021 US v. Texas. It's not up on Oyez yet, but it'll be there eventually. So this brings us to the arguments part. There are two types of arguments that revolve around abortion. One is whether it is morally permissible or not. And two is whether abortion laws are states' rights through Amendment 10 of the Constitution, or issues that should be handled and enforced by the national government. This would be selective incorporation from the 14th Amendment, because selective incorporation is incorporating the Bill of Rights, particular amendments of the Bill of Rights to the states, and selective incorporation uses the 14th Amendment to apply. In this case, it would be the right to privacy, which would be 1st, 3rd, 4th, and 9th Amendments based upon Griswold versus Connecticut. It would apply those rights to the states. And selective incorporation uses the Privileges and Immunities Clause and the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. The Due Process Clause, we've already said that one. But another one is Privileges and Immunities. Privileges and Immunities is in Article 4. This clause is also in Article 4 of the Constitution. I think it's Article 4 of the States Relations. I believe it is. Let's see. But this one is particularly in the 14th Amendment. And, yep, Article 4. And it says that No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges and immunities or immunities of citizens of the United States. That's how they use to, this is how they allow for selective incorporation. It started with Gitlow versus New York. You can look that one up. There are a lot of cases dealing with socialists in the first half of the 20th century. Another one was Schenck versus the United States. Debs. I think that was Debs v. the United States. Or U.S. v. Debs v. Yeah, Debs v. United States. It might have been U.S. v. Debs. No, Debs versus the United States. Lots of stuff with speech in the first 30 years of the 20th century, certainly. But anyway, basically, this argument... let's first look at argument one. So argument one is whether abortion is morally permissible or not. So there are two morals here. So this is why this argument is, there's no real answer to it. Because the moral is women's rights. So of course, women's rights is a huge moral obligation to grant more rights to women. We've definitely not done a pretty lackluster job on doing that. We've done some, I think we've done a lot of, almost, in terms of women's rights, I think we've done a lot of almost symbolizing things, but not in practice. We've done a lot of things that symbolize women's rights, but we haven't done a lot in practice. There's still no litigation related to employment, specifically equal pay. There is no argument on the other side in this situation. You can say that women are generally earlier into a job or whatever. Well, 71% of women go to college and 61% of men go to college. More women get bachelor's degrees than men get bachelor's degrees. And women can often be more experienced than men in the workplace. Yet, they don't get paid as much. And in effect, it basically is their gender that is, or their sex, particularly if it's a woman. That is the cause for this. It's not all these petty beliefs. It's truly a discrimination issue. And it has not been litigated yet. There's been no litigation related to it. Eventually the court will get to it, but that so far there hasn't been any significant developments there. But eventually it's a matter of time. So that's one thing. And another is this is the you have the woman's right the woman the women's rights as one moral one moral, and the other moral was the child's right to be alive, the potentiality of human life. This one's also difficult because, I mean, when you think of it, a lot of people who are pro-choice are against abortion in practice, but they can't see allowing it to not exist, because not letting it exist basically means that women are just going to get unsafe abortions. The problem with this brings us to another problem. The problem with banning Roe v. or with repealing Roe v. Wade is that it doesn't really do anything in the states in which they would just ban it. It actually probably makes it about much worse. It'll curb abortions, but at the expense of killing people who are already alive. And another thing about abortion is that a lot of people who have had it actually do not regret it. The last study I saw, I think it was the University of California, San Francisco, that posted it. UCLA, but I can't remember. 95% of women who get an abortion do not regret it. They believe it was a good idea. They may regret it, but they believe it was a good idea. It was the better choice. So that's obviously pretty important. But anyway, back to the moral. So this is one really difficult one because the potentiality of the human life. We regard the fetus as a truly incredible being. And scientifically, logically, it is a different being than the human who carries it. It is a mixture of genes. And it is truly unique from both the mother and the father, surrogacy is not, you could say the two people that helped make it, essentially, because surrogacy but that's not important. So essentially, that's another conflict, because this person is truly a separate human, not necessarily alive. By biological standards, it is not technically alive. Because as a whole, though its cells could probably survive without the womb, without the parent, it could not survive on its own. And it couldn't, I think it could not achieve mediostasis, something like that. There are a bunch of words related that define what the guidelines for something being considered life are. And it doesn't actually fit them, but it is a unique human. It is technically alive. It definitely is alive. It's made of living cells, but it's not alive by biological standards necessarily. But it is a different human being. And the question is whether we can allow that being to have its own rights as the fetus, or the woman not to have rights, or the woman to have rights as the parent, as the person bearing that child. So in this case, it's difficult, especially being someone on the outside. I am privileged as a man to not have to deal with this. I don't have to be the one who has to question whether to terminate my pregnancy or not, because I will never be pregnant. But there is still a moral conflict. I'm not talking about my own opinions here. I'm just saying there is a moral conflict in the United States related to this issue. Not as much with women. Women tend to support abortion much more than men do, depending on the study. But it's just a really difficult thing, especially when you are in a privileged position where you don't know. Really, a privileged position means you don't really understand it. I could never understand abortion, because I will never have to think about it. I'll never have to think about whether to terminate my pregnancy or not, because again, as I said, I'm never going to be pregnant. And also, being a teenager, I've never really had the experience to understand pregnancy and to understand stuff like that. So truly taking the humble approach is what I'm trying to go at right now. But this debate becomes extremely difficult, because you're looking at two moral judgments conflicting with one another directly, and there is no compromise. So that's one of the arguments. The other argument is more judicial. It's more law-based, constitutional law. And this one, contrary to what many people will tell you, this is not, this is the argument that the courts look at. This is not the argument. The general public does not look at this, but, well, they do, but they don't look at it quite in the same way. Now, with the newer cases, I listen to the arguments in a few of the arguments, a small amount of the arguments in U.S. v. Texas, and almost the entire argument in Dobbs v. Jackson. So I find it very hard to believe that they're still following this constitutional contradiction, and I think that it's more so a moral contradiction that is being argued in the courts than it is a constitutional contradiction anymore. This particular constitutional contradiction, this is, of course, everything that goes to the court in this situation is going to be a constitutional issue, but this, I'm talking about specifically national versus state rights. So states' rights are guaranteed by the 10th Amendment and, of course, Article 4 of the Constitution. Article 4 details interstate relations, so there are some requirements. And then the 10th Amendment grants all rights that are not enumerated in the Constitution or given to, not allowed to the states, not accorded to the states. Essentially, those rights, those laws, those are constitutional rights for the states. So this is the, and this contradicts with one thing, and that is selective incorporation in the 14th Amendment. So the 14th Amendment and the right to privacy, these are things that we've discussed for a long time now. It's at 45 minutes. This is a significant part of constitutional law and of this issue. We're looking at whether selective incorporation or states' rights are at play here. And this is a more difficult argument even than the issue itself. And actually, in a way, it derives from the issue because most of the people who argue for states' rights are arguing for anti-abortion laws, pro-life laws. And, well, I say pro-birth laws, not necessarily pro-life laws. I'm not saying I'm pro-choice or pro-life. I actually, for a long time, I was neutral. Again, privileged position. I'm objectively reasoning through my opinions, and I've fixed it. But essentially, I truly am as close as it can be to unbiased. And there is a significant contradiction. And it is true that that most of the people who believe in states' rights want anti-abortion laws. And most of the people who believe in national, federal supremacy want particularly abortion to be legal. Now, of course, saying that it derives from it, I mean, it does derive from it, but the issue at hand is whether 10th Amendment or 14th Amendment applies here. And as I said, this is more difficult because there is no enumeration in the Constitution. The right to privacy described and defended in the ruling, in the majority opinion for Roe v. Wade, is famously weak. It uses one amendment, the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, instead of in Griswold, which was 1st, 3rd, 4th, and 9th, and even what the plaintiffs argued, 1st, 4th, 5th, 9th, and 14th. It used only one amendment, and it didn't use the amendment that protected individual liberties, which is particularly the 9th Amendment. That amendment would have probably helped its reason. I'm not going to necessarily question the reason because I am not a constitutional lawyer, though I know many people around me who do have law degrees, who are civil rights attorneys, constitutional attorneys, or lawyers. They say that the ruling in Griswold would be stronger in Roe v. Wade than the current Roe v. Wade ruling. I mean, you can't change a decision, but that's essentially what it is. And this is where it was a combination of those factors which led to this constitutional debate that is truly a perfervid one, truly one that has been very annoying, very terse, and objectively horrifying because, again, this has caused some significant issues in our country. But overall, this debate between the 10th and 14th Amendment, between whether it's a states' rights right or a federal supremacy, where the federal government is supreme, it's difficult. There is much debate over that, and the constitutional basis for abortion is limited. Not necessarily saying that it doesn't exist, not necessarily saying that it shouldn't exist, but the constitutional basis provided in Roe v. Wade was limited. I am conflicted over whether to consider it a bad ruling, particularly because of I'm not talking about it as a bad ruling. I'm not saying that. I'm talking about bad justification. I'm not talking about the ruling. I'm not listing my opinion on the ruling right now. But I would argue that the justification was conflictingly poor. So 14th Amendment is strong in terms of due process, especially for especially in repealing a law that, in a way, does deprive a woman of liberty, particularly. The one issue with that is that it also deprives people of life, and this is where it kind of the reason kind of got a little fishy. But that this is where it gets difficult. And I would say that my opinion on whether this is a federal issue or a state issue, I think we need to look at what the effects, what the long-term effects are on women who don't have an abortion, not who choose not to have an abortion, but are not able to have one, whether they're not able to legally or because of whatever reasons. We should see how many of them do end up getting an abortion, as in through unhealthy means, unsafe means. We also need to look at how many of them regret their decision. We need to look at how many of them, how many of them have family issues, how many of them suffer from poverty, at least specifically compared to before they had their kids. How many of them are single parent households. We need to take in all these factors, and then we need to look at equal protection. We need to see if this is, if abortion violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Yes, men cannot be pregnant. But if this, if a pregnancy is said to violate a woman's right, and we are, that wouldn't be violated for men because they can't get pregnant. If it does, if it could theoretically violate a woman's right, then the argument for equal protection would be that they have the constitutional right to be equal protected in their rights and in the laws. They would be accorded the right to choose whether they have an abortion or not. So that is the argument we need to look into. That is my personal opinion on the argument itself. I'm not looking into the, I'm not giving my actual opinion on abortion right now. I will in a future episode, inference, foreshadowing. But that's it. This is the long discussion on the right to privacy and the very terse and perverted abortion argument and debate. Thank you all for listening, and as always, have a good morning, afternoon, evening, and night. We will see you next week.